What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. We are live at the, I don't know what year it is, but at SPATS 2016. We are at the South Padre Athletic Trainer Seminar. Definitely recommend checking it out. Very enjoyable experience so far. We've got the rest of the day today, and me and Nicole and Jasmine, I believe, are all going to rent mopeds and ride around the island as just part of our enjoyment of SPATS. So here's a question that me and Bubba were asking each other. We drove down from Houston, so it's about a six-hour drive. If you had to choose one of these, would you rather live life without knees or without elbows? Now, you still have your ankles and your wrists, you know.
Okay. I'd probably have to say without elbows, because at the same time, you can do a little bit more with your arms and wrists and hands are a little bit more tactile. But if you don't have your knees, there's a lot more you can trip over and a lot more issues you'd have at that point and stumbling around.
That's what I said. Bubba said he'd rather have knees and no elbows. I'd rather said I'd have no elbows and rather have knees. So I'm right there with you. So, all right, cool. Just a fun little question. And again, our trip down was really fun. We did a lot of Facebook Live and whatnot. So, okay, your talk was about the glass cannon. And that's the athlete that's really high level but has a seems to be very high tendency to just shatter or break. Is that an accurate definition, or would you?
I'd say that's a really accurate definition, actually, because like I was saying in the talk, it's one of those situations where when you have those kids, we've all met that athlete and we've all worked with that patient that they can hit the ball 1,000 feet, but the second that they trip or step off a curb wrong, they're out for 2 weeks. So again, like you said, it's that kid that's great at statistically awesome performance, but they shatter the second that something hits them.
Kind of, I'm not sure if you're an Astros fan or anything, but kind of reminds me of like Brad Lidge, like after Albert Pujols hit that home run, he just was never the same. I don't know if that's not really what we're talking about here.
I mean, that's going to be something that it could have very potentially had an effect on his career from the stress levels like we were talking about in the presentation.
Right.
And again, that's another area that didn't really get covered in that presentation, but those guys that are at that high level and are performing and have that pressure, anytime they do stumble or anytime they do have some issues, it's going to affect them much differently than that kid that's just a very average athlete.
All right, and then well, that's what you're saying there. The higher levels of psychological stress increases injury. Now, you gave a statistic in there, and I think you said twice as likely to get the injury. Can you clarify that for me?
So in that textbook from Granquist and his colleagues, that's a situation where they were the first ones to point out that the information they were going off of is still kind of in that infant stages, and we're still starting to understand more of it. But the studies that came out right now, they were able to narrow it down to about a 2 to 5 time increase based off of your stress for injury risk.
And then the stress, or the, was it like a very lengthy test? Or because I know you mentioned a life a stress test for collegiate athletes, mm-hmm. and I think I have that down here in the notes. But do you have any idea what the process for getting their stress levels were?
Well, the test that I pointed out in there, that was the one that was going off the stress levels for the collegiate athlete, that was the one I chose to highlight because it's one that you can do hard copy. You can have included with your health questionnaire that you already have that your athletes fill out on their health history. And it's not going to be one of the longer ones, and it may take them an extra 10 minutes or so whenever they're filling out all their paperwork. So it's not going to be one that is going to be super time-consuming and adds another 6 hours to your physical day whenever you're having your kids come through for their mass screenings.
All right. And I forget to mention this, but this episode will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/AndrewCageSPATS16. Right, Nicole? All right. So looking for this, and then I'll also have this link to the lecture, which we recorded, and then the presentations once they release those for us, I'll have that linked in there as well. So this will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/AndrewCageSPATS16. All right, so in the what can we do section, you said don't forget to focus on the person and not the injury. And that's something that I think I've learned over the years. You know, this would be my 12th year as a professional, or I just finished my 12th year as a professional, and that it's you have to take care of the kid, because I work with high school kids, mm-hmm. and not just, yeah, it is a torn ACL, but, you know, you have to have conversations, you know, okay, well, this is what I think it is. This is what we're going to do. Here's our plan. We're going to go see, you know, this doctor. I'm going to try and come see your surgery, and we're going to kind of work through all this stuff together. And, you know, this person, you can talk to them. They had the same surgery, and they're back to playing, and, you know, you can talk to them, that kind of thing, rather than just, all right, this is an ACL. This is one step, one, two, three, four, that kind of thing. But can you talk just a little bit more about how you have accomplished treating the injured athlete as an injured athlete rather than an injury?
Well, the first thing that I can say with that is kind of like you said, over my time in the profession, I've started to pick things up along the way. And early on, I was what I always call the typical cookbook athletic trainer, where somebody gets injured, I go get out my recipe book, and I say, okay, day one, we're doing these four exercises. Day two, we're doing these four exercises, and kind of going that route with it. And then as I started moving on through my career, I started seeing more and more kids that they were getting better, but they just weren't getting better as quickly as the cookbook told you they were supposed to get better. And so after a while, I just started kind of taking a closer look at it and saying, okay, well, this is happening and it's not going the way it's supposed to. Where can I get my information from? Where can I get some sort of outcome measure from, and kind of taking back to that patient-related outcomes? And so I started talking to the athletes and started finding out, well, hey, this actually is really easy to be doing these exercises. And I started figuring out you can progress them on exercises just by having a conversation with the kid. And then the more I started having conversations with the kids, I started to see more and more of the person. Had one patient that I worked with when I was living up in Baltimore who had several injuries. She was in the athletic training room every day. And one day I was sitting there and I was talking to her, and she was really concerned and she had her head down. And I said, what's wrong? And she looked at me and she said, oh, I was just praying over this. And I said, just without even thinking much of it, do you want me to pray with you? And after she got done almost crying, we sat there and we had a conversation, and we sat down and we prayed over her situation together. And she started showing up to rehab with a better mood. She started showing up with a better mindset. And then now she started having fewer injuries, and then ultimately stopped having to come in as often. So it was one of those things that little things over the career started to tick off in my head, where I was saying, okay, this isn't a cookbook profession. Each situation is going to be different. Each of these individuals is going to have their own set of problems and their own set of issues. And if I don't address the individual, I'm not going to be as effective as a professional as I could be.
All right. So on that, on the praying aspect, can you address that a little bit more? How you went about that, and like, are you comfortable doing that with any athlete, or do you only do that if they ask you to?
Well, it's interesting because I've spent my entire career working for state universities, and most high schools that people are going to be at are going to be state entities as well. And we talk about that separation of church and state. And so that's why it's a situation where I always talk about how it's a personal choice and it's a personal preference. Just like if teams are praying after the games, there's no player that's obligated to go out there and pray. And so as I've gotten to know patients, I will ask them if I know for a fact that they're Christian, just through context or through conversations we've had. I'll ask them if they want to pray, and a lot of times they'll say yes, sometimes they'll say no, and we just leave it at that. And it's a situation that, again, it's just up to their preference and up to what they're wanting to do. So that way I'm not stepping on toes, I'm not trying to force my beliefs on anybody, I'm not stepping outside the line of church and state, but at the same time I'm trying to take care of that individual. And if that's part of that individual's needs, is that spiritual healing and that spiritual companionship, then that's something that I think that's appropriate for us to do within reason.
All right. And in, as one of your stressors, have you found that that's in any cases added to the stress?
Not particularly. I think it's a situation where most of these kids, they look at their spirituality, whether it's Christianity or whether it's whatever belief system that they choose. That's a source of comfort. That's a or something that they can sit back and look at and say, okay, well, this isn't something that stresses me. This is something that I'm able to lift my stress and take off of myself with.
All right. Very good. Very good. So it's definitely something that I need to continue to look at. And, you know, I discuss those kind of things, but I'm not very good about asking the student, hey, you know, can we pray about this, that kind of thing. And so it's something I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned goal setting, and right before you, Brian Cologne spoke, and his was about patient reported outcomes. And I think that was really good that you were kind of tag teaming. I don't know if you planned it that way or if they planned it that way, but it's not just about the injury, but it's about, hey, how are you doing? What's your goal? And your goal may be to get to the bathroom by yourself today, mm-hmm. or maybe a walk up the stairs, or just shoot a basketball mm-hmm. from the free throw line, and that's it, you know. And so talk a little bit more about the goal setting that you mentioned as part of the stressors or the psychological factors.
Well, Brian and I have known each other for a long time now, and we didn't plan this out. We didn't know we were both going to be on the speaker bill together until we saw the brochure come out, in fact. But Natalie Coronado, whenever she puts together the program and the rest of the Valley Athletic Trainers Association, they do an awesome job of making sure that the talks do kind of intermingle. And so that was one of the first things that I noticed whenever I was watching Brian's talk and said, okay, well, we're going to be able to hit a lot of these same points. And whenever I was talking about the goal-setting side of things, like I was talking about in the presentation, it was a situation where we can use goals for good or for evil whenever we're doing our rehab programs with these kids, when we're trying to decrease those levels of stress and increase healing. Because if you have that obtainable goal, that gives that kid something concrete, something tangible. They can look at that goniometer and see, hey, I got back 10 degrees of motion, just like I said I was going to get 10 degrees back this week. But at the same time, if we try to make those goals too lofty and too unobtainable, that can take them back the other direction. That can slide them back down that motivation scale where now they're sitting there saying, well, Andrew told me that I was going to be able to come back and play, and now I can't do it yet. It takes away some trust in myself. They say, Andrew doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. And it also puts them in a situation where they say, this is when I was supposed to get better. I didn't get better. I'm never getting better. And so we want to try to avoid that with our goal setting, but at the same time, we also want to make sure that they have some sort of goal, because if we just let them be off with their minds on their own, that may not be the best thing in the world if we're just left to our own devices to try to interpret what's going on with our body and our rehab plan.
All right, so Bubba, my counterpart here, he said his talk was about progression-based ACL rehab rather than timeline-based, and that's kind of what you're saying is, you could set your goal to, okay, by the end of this week, we want, you know, we have to accomplish, you know, you have to be able to do calf raises, single leg balancing, and then we'll start riding the bike, and then we'll start jogging, and then we'll start running. And so if we can accomplish this by this time, but instead of saying you will be able to accomplish this, mm-hmm. you say, all right, so these are the steps we got to take. It just depends on you, how long it takes to get there. Is that kind of what you're...
Pretty much. And that's one of those areas where you all... Again, Bubba's spot on. You want to be careful about throwing times out there, because the last thing you want to do is answer the kid's question with a finite number whenever they say, hey, when am I going to be back? Because the second they're not back, you lose that trust, you increase their stress, decrease their compliance, and it just becomes a bad situation for everybody involved.
All right. And then I listened to Dave Ramsey, and one of the things he said was like to have SMART goals, and that's what, kind of what you're doing. That I know is specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-bound. I think you use slightly different words, but can you talk about why you chose those? Or
so, sure, and the words were a little different, but I mean the concept is always going to be the same whenever you're looking at stuff like that. Well, and specific is one of those goals whenever, or one of those parts of goal setting that we want to make sure that it makes sense, and we want to make sure that it's very defined, because the more defined we make it, the more quantifiable, the more tangible, the more that athlete has something they can just hold on to almost physically. So it's a situation where, like you said, we want to get you to where you're able to do calf raises and single leg balance this week versus we want to be able to progress your exercises. So now, again, we don't want to let that mind have too far to wander, because in that situation, they may start to have further issues. But moving on from that one, the attainable side of things, like I said, you don't want to tell that kid 2 months out from your ACL surgery, we're going to have you having a 36-inch vertical. I've seen a few freak athletes that are capable of doing things like that, but at the same time, that's still not going to be super realistic. And then, gosh, I'm having trouble remembering all of mine at this point, but at the same time, going back to, again, the time-based one, like we said already, that's just one of those things.
So they're missing the slide of answer. It's okay.
Sorry.
This isn't too formal.
Yeah.
So no, we're good.
No.
You didn't drop it in your bag, did you?
I don't believe so.
Do you need to check real quick? All right, so while he's checking to make sure he's not stealing stuff and taking it back to Tyler with him, again, we are talking with Andrew Cage, the athletic trainer at UT Tyler, and in his intro, they said they've been winning all sorts of awards and prizes for their sports medicine program. So, all right, we were talking about the SMART principle. You know, again, that's from Dave Ramsey, and yours was similar. So, specific, you said, just make sure it's intentional. This is our goal, measurable. Were we able to do, and then who's right before you? Boyles, Brian Boyles. And he was talking about, is it specific, as in, you know, we don't want you to ride a bike. You know, our goal isn't to get you to return to a bike, but our goal is to get you to return to your sport, that kind of thing. So it's making sure it's beneficial to the sport is where I was going with that. So measurable, attainable, realistic, time bound. So a little bit more about the time bound.
So with the time bound one, again, that's one of those ones where you have to be careful with it because you don't want to put your deadline too close. So you keep it general by saying things like this week or during this first phase, things like that, to where now you're able to incorporate, like Bubba was talking about, where it's still progress related, but we're still keeping some sort of title there to where they're able to identify with, I'm in phase one, I'm in phase two, phase three, what have you. Now, phase one doesn't necessarily mean the first 3 months anymore. Now it means phase one is until I have my full extension back and I'm able to lift at 40 or 50% compared bilaterally. Now at that point, we're at a situation where we can move on to that next phase and they're able to say, okay, I obtained these goals. I met my goals in phase one. I met my goals by the end of phase one, whether they have a time attached to that or not. And now I'm able to move on to phase two.
All right. Now, you also mentioned a consensus statement from the NATA about the psychological stressors and that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So the NATA came out with their statement in 2015. They put it together with just this big conglomeration of athletic trainers, team physicians, mental health care professionals, and lawyers to make sure they had every base covered, starting from the first point of contact, your primary care physician for that team, some person that's a mental health care advisor, and then also making sure there's lawyers there to help protect our high school kids because they are minors and they do need that representation. And you can make the argument that our entire patient population needs some sort of protection and representation for their rights and things that they may not necessarily know to advocate for. But as they were going through their statement, they did a really good job of outlining different behavior patterns and different behaviors that can be construed as risk factors for either high stress or people with what they called psychological concerns. And then outlined a way for secondary school athletic trainers to start to develop a plan for their school district, for their plan of referral and their plan of recognizing these kids.
Do you know off the top of your head, what is that plan called?
So
if I was to go to NATA website, what would I be searching for?
It's about 20 words long, and it's essentially it's an interdisciplinary statement on the process for recognition and referral of student athletes with a psychological concern at the secondary school level. And then they have their colon, a consensus statement that you have on any consensus statement.
So that was that title that you had
on the
slide. Okay. So again, when you see the slides, that'll be the title there. And he said it is really about 20 words long. So I couldn't type it all in my notes. All right. And then a gentleman, when we were walking over here, stopped to ask you about the insurance issue because he said here at his school, the kids, if insurance doesn't cover it, they don't go.
Yep.
And the insurance won't cover the psychological referral. So you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, and that's a very good point that he made at that point. And within my presentation, that's one of those areas where I was kind of guilty of just basing it again from going off of my collegiate perspective. But at the same time, he's absolutely right, and it's a situation where it's going to depend school district to school district what your plan for referral is. You make sure you have a plan for that referral so that way you have yourself covered and you have a plan in place. But right now, the question then becomes for these kids that don't have insurance, for these school districts where the student counselors don't necessarily feel comfortable having those conversations with those kids and trying to help them on that side of stuff, what's the next step? And frankly, I don't necessarily have an answer for it, other than the fact that that's a conversation that needs to be had, because one of the things that the consensus statement mentioned is that now more than ever, we're maybe not experiencing more, but there's a chance, but at the very least, we're recognizing more mental health issues and psychological concerns, not just within our student athlete population, but within the student population as a whole. And again, it may be because we're more sensitive to those things. It may be a situation where we're more educated. But at the same time, the fact remains is now we're identifying these situations where these people are having these psychological concerns. And it's not enough to just identify it. We have to have a plan for how to help these people.
All right. So I'm just thinking of an athlete that I had came in, you know, he's a pretty good kid. He's probably going to end up going to college. He asked me to check out his hand or look at his face or something, but he ended up telling me that he got into a fight with his stepdad, mm-hmm. and now he was actually staying at a hotel because he didn't want to stay at the house with his mom and his stepdad. And so I'm thinking back, like, I mean, I was like, you know, if there's anything you need, you know, you can come talk to me, but I probably at that point should have, you know, talked to the counselor, school counselor, or we should have had a plan to say, hey, what can we do here? I need to at least tell somebody else about this situation so that, you know, if it continues or if it gets worse, and we can deal with it. Thoughts?
And for sure, that's a situation where just from a liability standpoint for yourself, you have to make sure that you're talking with a principal, a superintendent, somebody that's further up the administrative chain so you can send it up the hierarchy to let them make a decision about how they would want to handle that situation. And that almost turns into more of a criminal situation as well, where you want to make sure that the administration is involved and they can make the best and most prudent decision about it. But at the same time, you can't underscore or you can't underestimate the act of just having a kid that was comfortable coming up and having a conversation with you about that sort of thing and what it might have meant to that kid just to know, hey, if I need anything, I have someone I can go to. So I have a coping resource. I have someone there that's concerned about my best interest and is willing to help me if I need it. Because a lot of times whenever you talk to these kids, again, it's just a situation. Sometimes it's just asking, hey, how's your day going? And I've had instances in the past where they sit there and they talk with me, and it's been a kid that I actually think would benefit from having a conversation with counseling services or with our different people that we have around our teams, our FCA representative, for instance. And by the end of the conversation with me, though, whenever I throw that out there, they say, well, I know he's a really nice guy, but I mean, I feel a lot better after just having a conversation, just getting it off my chest. If I need something, I will let you know. And if I feel like I need to talk to him, I'll let you know. But just haven't been able to have a conversation about it, I already feel 1,000 times better. So you can't necessarily sit there and just try, and not that you necessarily were, but you can't underestimate just being an outlet for that person to have a conversation. But at the same time, you do want to make sure you're protecting yourself from a liability standpoint as well, now that you are privy to that information.
Yeah, see, that's the hard part. We're always caught as like, do I need to send this on? Where, you know, how do I have that conversation? Because I had a girl come and ask for Band-Aids because she was cutting her arm. And I said, please don't say anything. It's like, look, I have to say something. I'll only tell the counselor and then we'll go from there. But I cannot just let this happen. One, because I care about you. Mm-hmm. And two, because it's illegal for me to not say something. So, you know, at that point there. But then with this other kid, is it illegal for me to not say something? And so, again, I don't want to, I guess I just need to ask my counselor, ask my assistant principal next time, say, hey, this is the case. Do I need to write up a report or anything? And then go from there. So,
yeah. And even if it's not necessarily a legality thing, it's also still a personal choice in a lot of those ways of saying, this is a situation where if there's any physical or mental harm that can come to those kids, that's usually my barometer. If it's a situation where if one of my patients has a risk for a higher risk, if you will, of physical or mental or emotional injury, then that's the point whenever I have to sit down and say, okay, well, yeah, they told me in confidence, but for me to be able to go put my head on the pillow tonight, I need to go make sure I have a conversation with someone about this.
Okay, and then you mentioned the plan. Where do we find, like, a written copy, an example, without having to reinvent the wheel, of a plan so that I can say, hey, let's mimic this and make it fit for my school?
Your best bet's going to be to Google policies and procedures for psychological referral within a school, and then that way you should be able to pop up, because in a lot of cases, I would imagine, it's something that people make available on their website so that way parents have access to it at all times. And that's the route a lot of colleges especially are going is, their policies and procedures, there are hard copies here and there and in filing cabinets and on bookshelves, but most of the time it's going to be on that website, so that way everybody has access to it, and that way there's complete transparency whenever it gets down to a liability standpoint of, no, this is our policy, this is a policy that's been posted forever and a day, and this is how we followed it. So we kept everything above board as we were dealing with whatever that situation may be.
All right, Andrew, if someone wants to find out more, get a hold of you, how are they going to do that?
So you can find my contact information on the UT Tyler Athletics page on uttylerpatriots.com, and my email address is acage@uttyler.edu. So those are the easiest ways to get in touch with me, and thanks to today's technology, I'm always having to answer emails. So
social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn?
Facebook, Andrew Cage, LinkedIn. I'm also in as Andrew Cage as well, so...
All right, there you go. So you can find them on one of those or email them, uttylerpatriots.com, athletics page, Andrew Cage. Talking about the glass cannon, I'm Jeremy, Sports Medicine Broadcast. This will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/AndrewCageSpats16, and then you'll be able to hear his lecture and the interview we had here. Thank you very much.